Okay, friends, I'm going to start as you find your way to your seats. And feel free to continue eating, but I'm just going to start preaching. So I'm Miriam Turlinchamp, and I'm the rabbi of the synagogue, and I welcome you into our home. I'm glad and proud to host an event like this, and I think of our congregational family, who many of them are here tonight, and all of you for being part of our congregation today. So in our creation story, God says, God blessed the seventh day and declared it holy, because on it God ceased from all the work of creation that God had done. And those last few words reflect a unique Jewish philosophy. We read that God ceased from all the work God had done, not that creation was finished, but rather that God was finished in God's role in creation, meaning that the holy seventh day is our day. The Sabbath is humanity's day to help further the creation of the world, and Jews believe that from the very beginning, human beings were meant to partner with God. 6 days a week, we work and concern ourselves with our personal well-being and productivity. And on the seventh day, we take respite from those behaviors and concentrate on what kind of world we are creating. And then we keep reading in the Torah, as Rob talked about, the Sabbath isn't just one day a week. We have a Shemitah year, that seventh year, where we let our land and workers rest. And then seven cycles of Shemitah brings us to the Jubilee year, where the land is returned, people are free, and wholeness is pursued. So Shabbat, Shemitah, and Jubilee are all products of our desire to allow for our role as partners of God to shine, while understanding that it is all too natural to work, care for your own, and forget the whole message of creation in the first place. So we're meeting here tonight because all of us in some form or another acknowledge that our civilization is built on principles that do not necessarily align with the priority of partnering with God. Partnering with God means creating like God, remembering the Garden of Eden and how we might be able to make our living world more like the original intention for all God's creatures. The world we live in is so far from the Garden of Eden. We live in a world where children are dying because families have no place to go as they flee war-torn countries. No one wants to take these people in who are seeking asylum in the tens of thousands. In our own backyards, people suffer humiliation, degradation, hunger. They have no place to go because no one wants to face the truth of what it means to change the situation. Humanity is in a very dark place right now. So who's at fault? Who can we blame? And what do we, us few, want to do about it? And that's what I think we're here to discuss, our role in the problem and our role in changing things. It is the pursuit of the Sabbath, Shemitah, and of course, Jubilee. In this Shabbat's Torah portion, Kitavo, the portion of the Jewish Bible that we read the Sabbath, it involves a litany of blessings and curses. And it presents a problematic theology that Jews have been wrestling with for centuries. If you do right by God, you may be blessed. And if you will go against God, then you will be cursed. And right in the middle of all those curses, there's one really, really awful one. Deuteronomy 28, and your life will hang before you, and you'll be frightened night and day, and you will not believe in your life. This is also the first phrase in the Midrash and Esther Rabbah. The ancient rabbis of the Mishnah explained that this verse relates to three types of people. First, and your life will hang before you, referring to the person who has enough grain for a year. And you will be frightened night and day, refers to the person who has to buy his grain each day from the miller. And you will not believe in your life, refers to the person who must buy his bread from the baker. The rabbis believe that providing for oneself is not a privilege, but rather a basic human right. And once we are without that right, we will suffer the greatest pain of all, which is not believing in our lives. The curse says that we will be reduced to feeling like we have no power over our lives. We will not just be scared of hardship, we will feel like there's no way to free ourselves from our suffering. Some of us have lived this curse before. Some of us may be living this curse right now. So I speak from our Jewish faith tradition here, acknowledging The Jews do not believe that it is God's will that someone can afford grain for a year while others cannot provide for their families. We do not believe that some of us are better because we have achieved a measure of financial stability in our lives. Jews believe that faith is an action. Faith is about justice. Faith is about bringing heaven into this earth. Faith is about choosing to not make decisions out of fear, but rather of a place of love. We read a verse every Sabbath as part of our liturgy. Pray as though everything depends on God. Act as though everything depends on you. This is what it means to have faith as a Jew. Let go of the quick fix. Embrace the fact that life both depends on you and God, both when things are going poorly and when things are going well. It's up to you to let God in. And letting God in doesn't mean letting God into the easy, pretty stuff. Letting God in means being willing to take a hard look at the work that needs to be done, acknowledging our role in the problem, and working with those to be impact to make tikkun, to heal the brokenness in the world. And the Jews know a great deal about brokenness. And for a while, we had a little bit of power, but quickly we were thrown out, and we had to figure out ways to survive. And I think the ways that we figured out how to survive was not to be annoying. At first, we were incentivized to let go of our agricultural roots. We stopped being farmers, and we started to make rules that it was a mitzvah, it was a commandment, it was honoring God to be literate, both women and men. Being literate, not just in being able to read, but also in numbers. And so the women and men became quite useful. And we agreed not to proselytize because it was getting us killed. And we agreed not to make buildings on the top of big hills and be showy because it was getting us killed. And then the big secret to our success of survival was our ability to network, to make friends and family with other Jews. So by seeing our fellow as family, suddenly we become great traders, and we can go from town to town to town. We've got a place to stay, we've got something to eat, we have a mutual language, and we trust each other. The plight of one Jew became the plight of all Jews. And I say this part with deep pride. We understand and take bold action when it comes to taking care of Jews, our brothers and our sisters. Not just 5,000 years ago, but now too, I think only in my lifetime, watching the Jewish community come together after the fall of the Shah and rescuing all kinds of Jews out of Iran. And if you're part of a Jewish faith community in the 80s, then you definitely remember the Russian immigrants coming in, and you were either hosted a family or provided a meal, or everyone was connected to these Jews who came forward from FSU to be part of our community. And then 10 years ago, we had the Ethiopian Jews, who had a different expression of Judaism, but we welcomed into Israel, and we made it possible for them to be there. And Israel is its whole other conversation, which maybe when we become really close, we can talk about. But 67 years of nationhood and this insistence, no matter what was going on or is going on in Israel, that it must exist and be a Jewish homeland. And why is that? Because we need it. Because we're still scared. Because we see the state of the world and we know that it can happen again. And the it is annihilation, the casting out to Babylon, the reduction of our people to second-class citizens, the rape and murder of our people in countless pogroms, crusades, attacks, centuries of violence, culminating in the Holocaust just 75 years ago. We know suffering and fear and the possibility of extinction. And every Jew, whether he knows it or not, has made a communal vow that we will not forget. And so then we come to the second part of our Jewish story, and that's our triumph in the United States. The small, decimated, broken people start to build. And we get to own actual stores, and we go to school. And we aren't allowed into country clubs, so we say, great, and we built our own. And then we just kept building. We build museums, we get into politics, we triumph in the educational system. We become the professionals, the doctors, the lawyers, the educators. 1.4% of the U.S. population is Jewish, and yet we, the chosen few, have a presence in our country far greater than our numbers attest. We've become a strong part of the success in the system, and we do it well. And this doesn't mean that there's no more blatant anti-Semitism happening every day in this country, the state, and the city. This doesn't mean we are freed from the stereotypes or threats to our livelihood. This doesn't mean that we don't fear for our safety, that requires us to have security at all times in our places of worship. But a response to "we will not forget" in the United States looks a lot like mastering the capitalist system, beating all the dissenters at their own game, and yet we still hold on to the same thinking that helped us get through all the hardship, helped us become strong and successful. We take care of our own. So this is the part of the conversation that's going to be difficult and uncomfortable, because I want to talk about some particular dirty laundry, and no one wants to hear dirty stuff about themselves in a public forum. So I just wanted to say that's what's going to happen now. I believe that the reason you share this dirty laundry about your own people, or your own family, or your own personhood, is because by sharing communal weaknesses, we might hear of other faith organizations, other individuals, who may share similar stories and modes of operating, collectively acknowledge that we're all part of a broken system. And the fact is, we're all complicit in dysfunctional systems, and it's through telling our truth, pretty or not, that paves the way to our freedom. So you ready? Okay. Taking care of our own isn't enough. It just isn't. We're sitting in a Reform Jewish synagogue. 38% of all American Jews are Reform Jews. We are part of a powerful, well-organized, well-funded, hyper-educated religious system. And it is the organized funding that I want to address. For those who don't know, Jews are not permitted to handle money on the Sabbath. So when the pews are full and we've inspired our people to give from the hearts, we can't pass the plate. What we do is we send you a monthly invoice, and that's called membership dues. A member in a synagogue may come 2 times a year, 52 times a year, or just call me when they need a rabbi for a life cycle. Regardless, it's all the same dues no matter how often you frequent our services. We say you can pay whatever you want, give from the heart, we're told. But remember, we still need to pay the electrical bill, the rabbi's pension, the gardener, the custodian, and all the many seemingly unspiritual things that keep our community going. And so we say, give what you can, but what we mean is, please pay the $1,800 a year so that we can support our $600,000 annual budget. Many people give what we ask, and some are unable. But regardless of how much you pay, there's still an expectation of affiliation. You must be called a member to benefit from the bounty of a synagogue. You must be a member of a synagogue to be part of the established Jewish worship community. And if you don't belong, then prepare to pay for the nose, through the nose, if you want me to come officiate at your wedding or your funeral or your bris. Being a member means you are contributing to the community. And after all, it makes good financial sense. It's not just us, it's every synagogue. Synagogues are primarily funded the same way. Almost all of us have budgets comprised of 50 to 60% dues, and the rest is made up of endowments and generous donations, and maybe some grants if you're really lucky. And because of this financial model, we are stuck in a painful cycle of seeing members as dollar signs, creating some strange faith country club where you're either part of us or separate from us. Where being a member means payment, means giving with the understanding that you are supporting a community that you will at some point in your life be able to benefit from. We feel quite keenly like we don't have enough. And all our reasons are absolutely real. We do need electricity, water bills, an expensive rabbi, staff. But when it comes to family, perhaps membership and dues are symptoms of being too wrapped up in the established system of how things must be. For many synagogues and the Jewish people, our first value is taking care of our own family. But sometimes in that process, in that system that keeps the lights humming, we forget that the human family is our family. Reform Jews triumph when it comes to inclusion. Gay, transgender, questioning, interfaith, intrafaith, immigrant, rich, poor, in our home, you're welcome. We believe this, and we champion the rights of the disenfranchised, and we do it well. But the truth is, that's only part of inclusion. Real inclusion involves a degree of revulsion. Inclusion involves risk and fear and frustration. Inclusion involves deep introspection about the ways we contribute to the systems that hold humans down. True inclusion is looking to someone who makes you uncomfortable, who doesn't fit our image of someone who belongs here. It's looking at our system of membership and dues, or the way we budget, and decide who belongs, who is family, and who gets our tzedakah, our charity, first. Inclusion isn't pretty or easy, yet inclusion is the secret to Tikkun Olam. Tikkun Olam means healing the world. And Jews believe it is our unique task to be a light unto the nations, to champion healing and wholeness in this world. And we are to do this by tempering justice with mercy, by working with other faiths to pursue their efforts in repairing the world. And when we all work together, the end goal is to bring about a messianic age. In other words, to build a heaven here on earth. Jews don't have a heaven that we go to when we die. We're just absorbed into God, into memory, and into the earth. But while we're still alive, there's a chance at heaven, because it's something we can build together. So what does heaven look like for Jews? Everyone has a place to sleep. Everyone has enough to eat. It's so painfully doable. Heaven isn't about riches for us, or having more than your neighbor. It isn't about winning or education or the right pair of shoes. Heaven and healing are about having enough. And it's our duty to live out that theology, to acknowledge the truth that we are all failing. We're all participants of taking care of our own, tricking ourselves that if we just take care of our own, everything will be okay. But it's just one piece of a story. The story that we're part of is bigger than what the Jews and Christians and Muslims have done wrong, what each of us has done to contribute to the problem. There's still another chapter to be written, and that chapter is Jubilee. We're partners of God. We've been asked to rethink our seventh day, not simply as a day of rest, but as a time in our future where freedom from debt, from overconsumption, from poisonous actions are gone, and all that is left is tikkun, is healing. So as we sit here together, perhaps discomforted by some of the words that have been shared, perhaps inspired by conversation from new relationships, sitting in a house of worship, we're connecting together as a wider community of faith. And our faith is that the world doesn't have to be like this, and that we have the power to change it. This heaven on earth is calling. Tikkun is possible. And the first place to start are the systems that we depend upon, the systems we believe that we need to maintain the way we live, while in fact are the very systems that keep us from seeing human dignity, prevent us from realizing that our family, our own people, are much bigger than membership, or the people we know, or the neighbors that we feel like helping. Tikkun is embracing the dirty, difficult, painful parts of inclusion, and then living it out as pure Torah-inspired faith. Thank you.